Let's go now to Cuba, where a group of young bloggers is campaigning for greater freedom of expression and internet access. The Cuban government says they're backed by anti-Castro forces abroad, and it treats them as a security threat. Nick Miroff reports on this virtual confrontation with real-world consequences.
Yoani Sanchez lives with her family in this small apartment in a Havana high-rise, and twice a week she transforms her living room into what she calls the Blogger Academy. About 30 students are crammed in here, some in their 20s, others in their 50s, all learning how to use WordPress, Wikipedia, and the tools of a digital revolution that Cuba's revolutionary leaders view warily. Today's class is about Twitter. Few Cubans have an internet connection, so Sanchez is showing these students how to send out tweets from their cell phones. There are a handful of laptops in the room and photocopies of articles with titles like "Can Journalism Be Participatory?" Sanchez is 34, with long black hair and the weary intensity of someone who's been living on the edge for a long time. Unfortunately, in Cuba, Sanchez says, the act of wanting to find out what the official media is hiding is viewed as an attack on the integrity of the state. But that's not our intention, she says. This is an educational project, not a political one. Sanchez's blog, Generation Y, is political, but not with a kind of overheated rhetoric that has characterized the Cuba debate for so long. It's a grim chronicle of daily life under socialism, written in brief literary sketches, and it's earned her several international awards. The blog is blocked on the island by the Cuban government, but it's accessible through third-party websites. Since she's not allowed to have an internet connection, Sanchez says she writes her blog from home. Then she goes to tourist hotels and emails several postings at a time to friends abroad who run the blog for her. They send back reader comments, which often number in the thousands. Among Cubans abroad, Sanchez has become the island's most famous symbol of opposition to the Castro government. But her name isn't mentioned in state-run newspapers or on TV here, and she's not widely known. When her activism has moved from the computer screen to the streets, the response from authorities has been swift. The Blogger Academy has been left alone so far, though some students say they've been harassed by police and had equipment confiscated. Orlando Luis Pardo is a 38-year-old blogger who's part of the academy.
We are Cubans, we are living in the revolution, or maybe in the post-revolution, and we are good persons. We do not pretend to create a chaos, social chaos. All the contrary. We pretend that the society opens, that people in Cuba regain somehow their hope in Cuba, because a lot of young people that I know will say, don't go there, you just have to find yourself, find your own money, and when you get some money, find your way out of the country.
Cuba's opposition bloggers have attracted the attention of President Obama, and he gave Sanchez an interview by email last fall. It's that degree of American enthusiasm for Sanchez that gives the Cuban government cause to view her and her group as a tool of U.S. foreign policy. In another apartment building on the opposite side of Havana's Revolution Square, journalist Rosa Miriam Elizalde is punching back at Cuba's critics from a Macintosh laptop in her bedroom. She's the editor of Cuba Debate, the pro-government website best known for its most famous contributor, retired President Fidel Castro. He writes a web feature called Fidel's Reflections. Today, Elizalde is following Sanchez's tweets and countering them with a few of her own. We're not talking about some blogger in Sweden, Elizalde says. We're talking about a blogger in Cuba, which the United States has been waging economic and political warfare against for the past 50 years, and this is just the latest form of that warfare. Just as Sanchez sees her small group standing up to the power of the Cuban state, Elizalde sees Cuba as the underdog, besieged by a hostile media and the giant to the north. She says she doesn't have a problem with the Blogger Academy, but to her, Sanchez's overnight fame and the international support for her blog seem like a coordinated campaign to attack Cuba. I think she's a symbol that's been constructed for a specific political purpose as part of an aggressive U.S. foreign policy, Elizalde says. She obviously gets a lot of technical support if she's running a site that's being translated into 18 languages. Sanchez says she'll continue using the money she's made from her writing and her awards to help other Cubans launch their own blogs. The site she runs had 6 bloggers a few months ago. Now it has 28, and Sanchez says the waiting list for her next Blogger Academy course is nearly full. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
This week we've been looking at the newest arena of international conflict, cyberspace. The internet, having brought the world together, is fast becoming a place where countries compete in a largely unregulated and unpoliced worldwide web. We're in an age of cyber espionage and global rivalries and preparations for cyber war. We could soon see a battle over who controls the internet. NPR's Tom Gjelten has been reporting on this. And Tom, where's the battlefield?
Well, Steve, you know what? I actually found a place in Northern Virginia nearby where you can see the internet in operation. It was at the office of a high-tech firm called VeriSign. And on one wall of the company's fourth-floor operations center there, there's a big color monitor with a lit-up map of the world. It's something like an internet traffic map. And Ken Silva, VeriSign's chief technology officer, told me what it shows.
At any given instant in time, we can see how many transactions at each location are going on. For example, in Miami, we're currently getting 60,000 queries per second. New York City is getting 77,000 per second. Tokyo is getting 50,000 per second.
A little explanation. Traffic on the internet involves one computer contacting another to get information. When you go to load some web page for the first time, your computer needs to find its way to the computer where that web page is stored. Not so easy with more than a billion computers connected to the internet worldwide. To reach the computer with the web page you want, you need that computer's internet address. It's a number. This is where VeriSign comes in. It's the .com white pages for the whole world. A computer anywhere on Earth that needs some new .com address is likely to find it through Ken Silva's VeriSign servers. These are the queries he's talking about, and business is booming.
Just a year ago, we were doing about two-thirds the volume of what we're doing today.
And today they're handling about 1 million internet address requests per second. The address system is what makes the internet work. It's overseen by the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN for short. To the extent there is one global authority over the internet, it's ICANN. The current ICANN head, a former California entrepreneur named Rod Beckstrom, is doing his best to keep the internet above politics.
And I believe in world unity, and I believe that the internet is an incredible platform for world unity and enhancing relationships and integrating commerce and societies.
And this is where global internet governance stands right now: neutral, apolitical, largely hands-off. But how long can that model be sustained given the tremendous rise in internet traffic and the growing strategic importance of the internet to countries with very different interests? It's not hard to imagine governments demanding more of a voice in the way the internet operates because of politics. Authorities in Iran, for example, are said to be considering a partial separation from the internet, creating instead a national internet that connects to the global internet in ways only the Iranian authorities can control. Jim Lewis directs the Technology and Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We could see a fragmentation of the internet. You would have choke points at which you would have to be approved, just like with passports in airports. Someone would look and say, am I going to let you into my country?
A country could do this by developing its own computer address file. Incoming or outgoing queries would have to go through a server with access to that special national file. Some requests for internet address numbers would get answered, others would not. Jim Lewis says such an internet system could put a country in a better position to fight a cyber war. Right now, if you launch a cyber attack and you're connected to the global internet, you can expose yourself to retaliation.
But if you could figure out some way to insulate yourself, you would be less uncertain about the consequences of your attack and therefore more willing to launch them.
Of course, there is a downside to taking yourself off the global internet. Nations benefit from being part of a larger community, economically, scientifically, culturally. Rod Beckstrom at ICANN calls it the network effect, and he doubts any country would forego it.
And the truth is, there's never been a greater network on the planet Earth than the internet. So in as much as people want to talk about fragmenting, they've really only done it on a test basis. Why? Because you cut yourself off from the rest of the world. You lose the network effect.
But the internet could be politicized in other ways. Steven Spoonamore, a cyber entrepreneur with extensive experience in China, thinks that country's leadership has its eyes on ICANN, the one internet rulemaking authority. Already, China has more internet users than any other country in the world. Visionary Chinese, Spoonamore says, dream about taking over the internet, not insulating themselves from it as the Iranians might.
The Chinese IT guys I've met are really smart dudes and gals, and they're good. And they look at this and go, that would limit us.
Yeah.
I would rather do something more sophisticated, like control every switch in the world and every search in the world.
Many internet experts say that's a far-fetched notion. It would mean taking over ICANN, which is now directed by an international board with representatives of non-governmental organizations. China would presumably have to get its functions moved to the United Nations or another body where the Chinese have clout. And even if China controlled ICANN, it would have to dig deeper into actual internet operations than ICANN does now in order to gain control over user searches. But Spoonamore says it could happen.
Technically, not hard. Policy-wise, I think it's a big lift to try and get it to happen. But I have a huge respect. You know, I've done quite a bit of work in China and have huge respect for their ability to say, this is going to be the big lift, and we'll dedicate a decade to getting the big lift done.
All we really know, Steve, is that the internet has become something no one dreamed of 20 years ago, and that means no one really knows how it will evolve in the future or who, if anyone, will control it.
NPR's Tom Gelton has been covering internet security this week. And Tom, all week we've been hearing allusions to the Chinese. What does the Chinese government say, if anything, about these suggestions that they're scheming to take over the internet?
They don't say very much, Steve. At one point, you know, about 5 years ago, they actually did make a push to dismantle ICANN and move it to the UN. They've since dropped that effort. They're now working closely with the ICANN leadership, but they do still argue that internet governance should be more internationalized. They feel it's too U.S.-dominated. Remember, the internet was a U.S. invention, and for much of its history, the U.S. government did have a leading role in its governance.
So having talked to Americans about their concerns about internet security, what's the main conclusion you've come away with?
Steve, I don't think we've really yet grasped the extent to which cyber and the internet have really changed the security landscape. I mean, both the way espionage and warfighting has changed and also where it'll occur. It's a whole new battle space, and our whole thinking about national security has to change.
NPR's Tom Gelton, thanks very much.
You bet, Steve.
And if you missed any of Tom's earlier reports, you can find them at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Colleges and universities are trying to cut costs, so many schools are trading in-house email systems for Gmail. Google gives them more storage space, plus modern tools for collaboration, all at a very competitive price, free. WNPR's Libby Kahn Franklin reports.
Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, promises all of its students a Wesleyan email account for life. So when the university outsourced its email service to Google in late 2008, it had one big thing in mind.
What we said that we would do, we committed to making all the functionality that they had from their old system plus more, and the plus more, the big plus more, was space. We were running out of space.
Karen Warren is director of user and technical services at Wesleyan. She says that even before the switch, more than half the student body was using Gmail to bypass the Wesleyan mail interface. Nicholas Marshall is a senior at Wesleyan.
Clunky would be a charitable description of how the email used to work. And the thing that I've most noticed after the switch over to Google is that things have become a lot more streamlined and things have become a lot more centralized.
Centralization is perhaps the key theme of cloud computing. Data that used to be stored on-site is increasingly stored on huge data farms in remote locations. And because Google is, well, Google, it's able to offer 7 gigs of storage space to every student at Wesleyan and to the more than 7.5 million students around the world who use Google Apps for education, saving their university's time, money, and precious disk space. Plus, the apps are pretty cool.
This is our Google Apps start page. We've brought in several feeds from our student newspaper, from some of our active blogs on campus, and our events calendar.
From there, students can access email, docs, chat, video, spreadsheets, and more. But the kicker?
There are absolutely no ads in this interface at all.
It is not part of a strategy to make money.
Kristen Frodella is a senior marketing manager for education at Google.
Give it away for free now. We plan to always give it away for free. You know, Google actually started in the education world. And so we'd like to continue to support education, and we think this is a great way for us to support it.
So no charge, no ads. What's the catch?
That's a very good question. The answer isn't entirely clear.
Christian Czar is a senior at Yale University majoring in computer science. He was concerned when he heard that Yale was planning to migrate student email to Google.
Gmail is nice. All your email is there. There are some distinct privacy concerns because Google now has complete access to your email in order to show it to you.
Kristen Verdella at Google says students shouldn't worry.
The school owns all the students' private data. We are not looking at it. The school owns all of it.
That doesn't necessarily comfort Christian Czar. Not that his worries keep him from using Google altogether. He is, after all, a millennial. He's actually got 5 personal Gmail accounts, but it's a service he opts into and can opt out of any time. He doesn't want his school making that decision for him. And for the time being, at least, it won't. Yale has put its plans to go Google on hold, but has declined to elaborate on the decision or its future plans. For NPR News, I'm Libby Kahn-Franklin in New Haven.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. It's a safe bet that the last thing you'd do after losing your job is give away money. Reed Sandridge was laid off last year as director of a nonprofit group in Washington, D.C. The 36-year-old came up with a pet project to keep him busy while he looked for work. He calls it the Year of Giving. Every day, Sandridge walks up to a stranger and gives away $10. So far, he's handed out close to $1,200. He also interviews the recipients about their lives and posts their stories on his blog. Think of it as Studs Terkel meets Santa Claus. Reed Sandridge agreed to meet us in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown neighborhood on a very busy corner above a metro stop. It wasn't long before he stopped someone on the street and started making his pitch.
So my name is Reed Sandridge, and would love to give him $10 today.
You must have a lot of money to be able to do that.
What is your name?
It's Molly, M-O-L-L-Y.
What are you doing today?
I should be studying, and instead I'm going to go shopping.
So what do you think you might use the $10 for?
In all honesty, I'm going to probably use it on Starbucks.
Do you practice any giving on your own?
I did like tutoring for a shelter, and then Thursdays, well, it was a transitional housing program, and then Thursdays I taught an exercise class for women at a shelter.
Could I take a photo or a quick video of you?
Initially I was reluctant to stop with my bike helmet, my unshowered hair, I don't know.
While we're waiting for your picture, I'm Leanne Hansen from National Public Radio.
Oh, okay.
Molly, whatever possessed you to stop when this guy in a pink tie said, "Can I speak to you for a minute?" I mean, what went through your mind first?
Well, generally, first, I'm like, is he going to ask me for money? No, generally, I'm a nice person and I'm pretty social, so.
I know you're going to spend your $10 on Starbucks, but will you pay it forward?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I believe in that strongly. It's that whole karma. What goes around comes around. Good energy, all that.
Reed, why are you doing this?
Well, I got laid off of my job back in October, and I really wanted to concentrate on doing something that would give me an opportunity to interact with my community and maybe inspire others. But when I got laid off and I had this idea, I started thinking, can I do this? So I looked at what's the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario was 1 year without work.
Yeah, but you haven't found a job yet, right?
Nope. I'm usually not so dressed up, but I'm going to a job interview. So
beautiful pink polka dot tie, white shirt, gray suit. You know, you're the perfect model of a job interviewee.
Great, thank you.
So, what other kinds of people have you given your money away to?
I've given to homeless people. I've given to executives of company. I gave to the president of a small brewery. I gave to all kinds of people. I think that's what makes it interesting is to actually get a diverse group of individuals.
Has anyone turned you down?
Lots of people have turned me down.
What reasons do they give?
The most common reason is people say that they don't feel that they're deserving. And I didn't want to kind of influence people's decision, but at some point, I've started telling people, if you don't feel that you're deserving, you don't necessarily need to keep it. You could do anything you want with it. And I'm still surprised that I would say most of those people who deny or decline to participate, even after I tell them that, they still choose not to participate.
Ah.
Maybe they just don't have time. I hear a lot of times I don't want to get involved.
And there were people worried you want something from them for that $10 and really all you want is their story.
Yes, there was a great woman I approached one day and I said, can you help me with a project? She goes, I don't have any money. And I said, well, that's great because I'm going to give you $10.
Reed Sandridge, thanks a lot and good luck on your job interview later.
Thank you very much.
You can find a link to Reed's blog by going to our website, npr.org.
The world leaders attending the Washington summit will be looking for ways to limit the spread of nuclear arms and the weapons-grade material used to make those bombs. But there is a related concern about a new technology that could make it much easier to secretly refine uranium for bombs. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Right now, the technology to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons is big and cumbersome. Typically, countries build enormous centrifuge plants. And Francis Slakey, a physicist at Georgetown University, says it's relatively easy to catch wind of a project like that.
If somebody's trying to build a covert plant to enrich uranium, they're going to have to move a lot of dirt. We're going to see that with our satellites. They're going to have to feed it a lot of power. So we're either going to see power lines going in, we're going to see the construction of a dedicated power plant, or maybe it's going to even just glow and our infrared sensors can pick it up.
So Slakey is nervous about a new technology that's been developed to enrich uranium. It's intended to make fuel for nuclear power plants, but it could be used for weapons too. This technology uses lasers to separate out the desired isotope of uranium.
It has a lot of appeal, just from physics terms.
But the downside is a laser-based enrichment plant can be much smaller and use much less electricity. And that could make a clandestine operation much harder to detect, he says.
That's the worry. That's the worry. Things are starting to get so small and so efficient that it's below the detection limit, which creates an enormous proliferation challenge.
More than a dozen nations have tried at one time or another to develop laser enrichment technologies, Slakey says. Most gave up, but an Australian company called Silex has apparently succeeded. That technology has been licensed to General Electric Hitachi in the United States, and that company has applied for a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build a plant. In a recent opinion piece in Nature magazine, Slakey and a colleague at UC Irvine asked the NRC to do something it doesn't normally do, that is, decide whether to scuttle a technology altogether because of its proliferation risks.
Both my co-author and I are advocates of nuclear power. We're strongly in favor of nuclear power, but we think it's in the best interest of expansion of nuclear power to manage very carefully the proliferation risks.
GE Hitachi declined interview requests for this story, but in emailed comments, the company said the NRC should not judge proliferation risks as part of its licensing process. The company says it already has the go-ahead from other federal agencies that deal with proliferation. But NRC Chairman Greg Yoxko says his agency has national security responsibilities.
It's a very new technology or a novel technology. It's not similar to the kinds of enrichment facilities we've licensed in the past. So I certainly think that there may be some things there that we need to take a look at and make sure that we've got the right approach to ensuring that kind of protection of the technology and the material.
Yoxko said the review would focus on whether the company's security measures are adequate to protect the secrets of the technology. That's a more limited question than asking whether the technology is inherently risky and simply shouldn't be developed at all. The NRC has not historically considered such sweeping questions and is cautious about starting that now.
We don't necessarily want to be changing the rules in the middle of the game, but we also want to make sure that we've looked at all the issues and properly addressed it.
But Francis Slakey at Georgetown doubts whether strong security measures alone will be adequate in this case.
There's been a number of different technologies to enrich uranium. Every single one of them, despite best efforts to keep secrets, every single one of them has proliferated.
This one will eventually spread as well, he figures, but it's likely to take a lot longer if no legitimate user presses forward to perfect it in the first place. Richard Harris, NPR News.
All the single ladies, 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 all the single ladies,
all the single ladies,
watch your hands up, up in the club.
Add this song to the long and growing list of YouTube sensations. It's the band Pomplamoose doing their take on Beyoncé's inescapable hit, Single Ladies.
Like it, then you should have put a ring on it.
Pomplamoose does not have a record deal or a publicist, but they have had almost 4 million hits on this music video. Like all of their other videos, the duo appears in one quick shot after another, playing multiple instruments, and they're both jammed in to a spare bedroom of their house. Natalie Dawn and Jack Conti are Pomplamoose. Jack explained to me that the band has rules when it comes to how they shoot what they call video songs.
There's no hidden sounds, there's no lip syncing, there's no overdubbing. What you see is what you hear. So basically anything that you see in the video is exactly the take that was used.
Right. So if you see me singing, it's that actual vocal take that we used in the final mix.
Right. So sometimes there might be two or three Natalie's harmonizing with herself, and then you'll see those three videos juxtaposed together on the same screen.
I see. Okay. In this video, there is what you might call no glitz. A serious absence of satin, as they said. Jane Austen. You're wearing comfortable clothes. You appear to be in a bedroom. You can see the wallpaper and the wooden door. Are you opposed to glittery music presentations?
I guess I kind of don't like how there's such a pedestal for music culture, and especially for band culture. It just feels fake. It feels like smoke and mirrors, and I feel like music doesn't have to be like that. It can be something that's very normal and very accessible.
Now, the song Single Ladies is featured on what you call on your website an album, Tribute to Famous People. Can I just walk into Borders and buy that?
Afraid not. We haven't really printed any of our albums.
So they're sort of virtually albums?
Yeah, we don't have any physical CDs. We've never had a physical CD. But we make our living off of album sales.
I was just going to say, how do you make a living? Is this a career?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we make our living off of MP3 sales.
Full-time. We don't have any other job.
And people can just download your music or your videos as they want to?
Yeah, that's right.
We sold about 100,000 songs last year.
Well, let's listen to another one of the covers. This is the Earth, Wind, and Fire hit September.
Do you remember the 21st night of September? Love was changing the minds of pretenders while chasing the clouds away.
This video has only been seen 1.2 million times, so I guess this is not one of your bigger hits. Let me ask you about this. Pomplamoose is one of the first bands that was accepted into YouTube's Musicians Wanted program. Tell me about that.
It's ad revenue sharing. So YouTube will run an ad next to or on a video, and they'll share the revenue of that ad with the musician. It's a 50-50 split. It's a great system because YouTube doesn't have to do it, but they want to encourage people to upload content.
So is it totally old-fashioned to think of a record label as the best way to become a hit band? My understanding is that ultimately, if you really want to make the big bucks, you've got to have the record label, you've got to have their distribution, their promotion. That is the way to go still.
There's no simple answer to the question, I don't think.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't just do it all yourself, then you do need help. If, for example, you're somebody who writes songs like Lady Gaga and you need everything, you know, that's going to make you Lady Gaga, then you need a big fat label. But if you're just a band, I don't think we're in an era anymore where you need that sort of major backing.
Yeah, I mean, what does it mean really to need a label? I mean, we're making a living. We've got a sustainable business. We're growing every year as a good business should. We're happy. We don't have to do things that we don't want to do. We don't have to please people that we don't want to please. We get to make the music that we love. Yeah, we're not on the front page of Rolling Stone magazine, and we're not getting $10 million checks in the mail, but we don't need that to have a nice life.
And also, our goal has never been to be a huge hit band. We just
want to make a living doing what we like to do.
Exactly. Yeah. We're just making a living.
Now, Natalie mentioned songwriters, people who produce original music, which you also do. We've played clips of covers, but let's take one of those original recordings as well. Centrifuge, this is called. Even Each of you plays a number of instruments. There's a lot of quick cutting in this video. It looks like a fairly complicated process. How long does it take to produce a video song?
Not that long.
Yeah, it's very deceptive.
Oh, I see.
We write the song, and then it only takes a day or two to record all the parts, sometimes three. And then Natalie does the editing in about a day, or sometimes 2 days.
I prefer to do it in 2 days. Just to be safe, we'll say it takes about a week from start to finish, from writing the song to uploading it onto YouTube. It takes about a week.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, when we want to do something, we do it right away. Like when that Lady Gaga song Telephone came out, we liked the song, we wanted to cover it, and we literally did that audio recording in 24 hours. And then Natalie edited it the next day, and in 48 hours of deciding to do that song, it was posted on YouTube.
So what happens if Lady Gaga turns around and says, wait a minute, did I sell the rights to that song and just don't remember it?
Oh, no, we make sure that we have all our ducks in a row. We bought mechanical licenses to all of our covers before we put them on iTunes, so it's all legit and legal.
We were sort of curious about that because you'd think that would be one of the parts of the process that wouldn't be so speedy.
Yeah. No, but it's really easy. You go onto harryfox.com, you click buy mechanical license, and boom.
That's the thing. People think that like all of these things have to be done by like geniuses who are like behind huge desks and, at the top of skyscrapers. But actually, you can just go online and
buy
do
rights.
It yourself.
Yeah, it's really easy.
Can you go out on tour with a video song band? Does that work? Can you play in a club? Or are you just not dealing with that?
We don't love... well, that's not true. We do love playing live. It's just a lot of work right now to set up a live show. And the thing is, because of how we record our songs, we have to relearn all of our songs if we want to play them live. So we don't, like, know
Mostly
our songs.
Me.
Yeah. but what we do is we play with a drummer, and what we lose in orchestration, we hope we make up for in energy. It's a really fun, crazy show with lots of screaming and silliness.
Yeah.
And
diving
yeah,
for different instruments here and there.
Exactly. Yeah, we bring a bunch of stuff. And I guess when we played at Brainwash 6 months ago, we had about 400 people there. So it was pretty – I mean, I think we could go on a tour if we wanted to at this point.
And by 400, we mean 200 inside and 200 outside looking through the windows.
Right, because it was a tiny club.
It was a tiny venue. We were just not prepared for it.
Yeah.
But and we went outside into this little alley and all the like 200 people gathered around us. And it was just Jack with an accordion and me singing La Vie en Rose. And a bunch of taxis were slowing down and stopping to watch us like, what is going on?
And then everybody sang along. It was like, it was really fun.
It was great.
Quand il me prend dans ses bras et me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose.
Jack Conti and Natalie Don are Pomplemousse. Their newest album, virtual album, is called Tribute to Famous People. You can see their work all over YouTube. They joined me from member station KQED in San Francisco. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie.
You can find a few of their video songs at our website, nprmusic.org. And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Guy Raz returns next weekend. Thanks for listening. Have a great night.